With a whole stadium racially chanting Vinicius Jr. recently in a game in Spain, me and Haz dive in to racism, how much it still exists, and what we need to do. I hope you're sitting comfortably, because this is about to get uncomfortable.
This is 115 Miles with Josh Connolly and Hassan Kaya. We hope you're sitting comfortably because this is about to get uncomfortable.
Hassan, we are live, mate, in a different and new studio today.
Yeah.
I turned up in Bow. I don't know if I've ever been here.
But it felt like a homage to your early days, right?
It That's did, what I was gonna man. Say. It looks nothing like I was expecting to see, like, groups of lads huddled on the corner spitting bars.
I'm sure you can still get that
I'm
somewhere.
I'm such a tourist in London.
Yeah, man, I know. Middle class.
Is that new to be middle class in Bow, by the way?
I don't know.
I was listening to Wiley on the way here as a result.
Just to get you warmed up?
Just because it made me think, I'm going to listen to him. He's the godfather, mate.
Yeah.
Any?
Have you read that book yet?
No.
That I bought you.
Have you about read it?
I have read it. What, cover
all
to
of
cover.
It? All yeah. of it.
I actually finished this book.
Fuck off.
I did.
No, I don't believe you.
It was good.
I don't believe you. You've read every chapter front to back.
Chapter and verse. Front to back. Lots of trips to Ayanapa, back. Beefs. It's good. You should read it.
We didn't know at the time, yeah, that we were part of such a big movement.
Do you mean me and you or just
No, me, man. You weren't part of the movement.
No. Nah.
What's
that club you used to go to?
Bruno.
Yeah.
Bruno
Rooms.
Mate, Heartless Crew, which is in that book, innit?
Yeah.
Mate, they were the days, man. And Wiley and Dizzy have probably produced the greatest set of all time. Have you heard the Wiley and Dizzy? You haven't heard it?
Where, at Bruno Rooms?
No. Is that a Sidewinder? I don't think it's Bruno.
Oh.
But it's them two. Mate, I've got to show you it afterwards. It's on YouTube.
Okay.
It's the greatest set of all time.
Gonna spit a couple of bars from there?
I can do the whole thing back to back, Wiley and Dizzy's.
Well, you have to beat Ed's Angels rendition, don't you?
but yeah, good. You got here all right then, mate. To Bow, is it hard for you to get here?
What are you talking about, man? This is my end, kind of. All northeast. It's like, you know, it's where I grew up.
Is this near where you grew up?
It's not that far. Yeah, it's not that far.
Did you ever venture into Bow? Did you ever have like a...
I lived in Leighton for a while, so that's just outside of Stratford. It's not too far.
Did you
far.
Have like wars with these people?
Oh, what, postcode wars?
Yeah.
I wasn't that kind of guy. It's so funny. I can see you like trying not to laugh too hard because you're...
I've got sore lips, man. So every time
I'm going to really try and make
hurts.
You laugh, man.
Well, I've got no worries on that front. Yeah. So how you doing, mate? Let's start with the bit of the check-in. Actually, the way that I'm going to do the check-in today is a little bit different. I want to give you a little bit more so that I can get a little bit more out of you. So with the check-in, I want you to tell me one thing that you struggled with. Let's start there. One thing that you've struggled with in the last week or weeks gone by.
Struggle's a hard word, isn't it, really? Like,
no, it's not. It's really easy, mate. It just means that you fucking found it difficult.
I just glide through life, Josh, you know. struggled. I think the thing I've struggled with is, if I go back to the start of the year, what, you know, I've talked about the pyramid of priority and, you know, for me, I decided that what I needed to do was really focus on three things. And the top priority for me for this year was sleep, because I haven't done that before. And I think that was the cascading effect to like a lot of the change that I've had this year, which has been brilliant. I'll say the thing I've struggled with is maintaining that, you know, so it's easy to get to the top, but it's hard to stay there, right? So yeah. I think everything was going really well. But then as I've got a bit busier, as I've started to let a few bad habits creep in, I might be scrolling like TikTok or Instagram a bit later than I should. So I'm firing up my sort of dopamine a bit later than I would. I'm asleep. So that's probably had the thing that's had the biggest effect for me, because it's not the lack of sleeping, which is one thing, it's the sort of the knock-on effect of not having a good night's sleep, which is something that I just need to nip in the bud. And that might sound a bit trivial, but when I've attributed so much of my positive change to that and kind of, you know, the clarity that you get from it, I think that's the thing that sort of crept in little bit.
Genuine question, do you ever meet many people who put these systems in place and then live by them all of the time.
No. No, and I'm not sort of beat myself up for letting...
I know you're not. Like, yeah. I've pushed you to answer the to answer the question. Yeah.
No, but that's something I was thinking about even outside of the question. It's like, for me, that's an important part of the identity that I want to create moving forward. It isn't just, oh, I just want to do a little bit for a little while. It's an important part. So actually, it's in these moments where it starts to drift a little bit, you've got to put the effort in. It's a bit like saying, you know, like, for every sort of ordinary Joe on the street, they're going to have those dips, but the, I don't know, elite athletes in their prime, the elite athletes, they have to keep showing up.
Yeah.
To form those habits, you have to keep showing up even when you don't want to.
Yeah.
And oh, so the knock-on effect as well is what I was doing is sleep, having good sleep, but then the following morning I'd get up around 5:45, do my workout. And that has had a bit of an impact on my sort of desire to get up and do the workout. So there's definitely been days where I had planned to get up and I thought, oh, I'm too tired, so I'm not going to do it. And that, and so I've just, where I was doing like 4-5 workouts in a week, that's last couple of weeks, it's sort of drifted to 2-3 maybe, you know what I mean? So it's definitely having an impact.
Yeah. What's TikTok feeding you at the moment, videos wise?
I've been watching this guy, Mizzy, go, like, he's been blowing up, but basically he was doing pranks where he walked into someone's house in Hackney and then it blew up. And so then what you do is because you've watched that video, you then get people commenting on videos. So that's what seems to be happening on TikTok.
Yeah, you mentioned him. You know what TikTok's feeding me at the moment? WWF circa 1995 to 2005. I don't know where it's from, where the clips are from, but it is all like Stone Cold Steve Austin, The Undertaker. They're all sat around Mick Foley. They're all sat around a table talking about how shit went down. Like podcasting, video podcasting.
Oh, so them now, yeah?
Yeah. And these TikTok things, it keeps feeding me them, yeah? And they're long videos. Some of them are like 5-10 minutes long, maybe even a little bit longer.
Yeah.
And they'll talk about, do you remember... mate, this is going off topic a little bit. Do you remember The Undertaker against Mankind, Hell in a Cell? With all the pins and all that.
You're talking to me like I was a big fan.
Was you not a big fan of wrestling?
A bit earlier than that. Ultimate Warrior, Hulk Hogan.
They were talking about how bad a wrestler the Ultimate Warrior was.
Yeah.
So I didn't realize.
He was proper jacked, wasn't he?
Steroids. And then there was a documentary of it on Netflix back then. I went to school dressed as him once. I think I've told you that before. When I was about 7, I went fancy dress at school.
You could still get away with it, couldn't you?
Oh, I got the body, mate.
Yeah, you got the hair and the painted face as well.
But they were talking about how like unscripted a lot of it was. So it wasn't real, but they would have...
the moves, like the fights?
Yeah, so they wouldn't be too orchestrated. It would be, you know, if it was like me and you, they would say Hass needs to win at the end. And it's going to be we want you to fight for 4 or 5 minutes. And then they would go out and they would know each other's moves and all of that. But it wouldn't necessarily be like, I'm going to throw you against the rope and then you'll pirouette and all that sort of stuff.
You're joking. Because it always looked really choreographed.
No, but if it looked choreographed, it's just, they would say that they were bad wrestlers. So you know Stone Cold Steve Austin?
Yeah.
So he got, you know DDT, when they pick you up, put your hand between your legs and drop down on the knees?
Yeah.
He was fighting Owen Hart. I've got another story very quickly. I've got to tell you about that in a minute. And he paralyzed. He went paralyzed. He did the DDT on him and he was like, my head slipped down a bit too far. And he was like, he was supposed to finish me and then I was going to roll him over and beat him.
Yeah.
He said, and as he come near me, I had to say, don't touch me. I can't move anything from my neck down. So then Owen, and they showed a clip, Owen Hart's like walking around the ring, G'ing up the crowd. And he's like, he's just giving me time to get back. And then he said, I just managed to get the energy to roll him over, and they showed it was a really bad rolling him over to win. And he's like, and I had to change the type of wrestler I was. I was acrobatic till then, and then he became like the brawler with the knee brace. Yeah. When Owen Hart died, you know he died, yeah? So Owen Hart was a wrestler. On one of the SummerSlam things, he was supposed to come down from the ceiling, and the thingy snapped halfway down, and he fell and died in the ring.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they showed, because it was on live on TV... This is mental, right? This is all true. This is not like, this is like true happened. They played the rest, they went on with the show. And they showed this on TikTok, I was watching, yeah? So they're like, he keeps going to the commentator and he's like, Owen Hart is in a bad way. He's in the ring. They're doing CPR on him now. This is not part of the act. This is real life. I don't know what to tell you. We will be continuing with the show. And then they get Owen Hart out. It goes to an ad break.
And then they're back.
It comes back and he says, before we go into the tag team match that's coming up next, I hate to be the bearer of this news, but I have to tell you that Owen Hart has died tonight. And then they carried on with the show, mate.
No. That's Vince McMahon, isn't it?
That is mental that they did that. How? That's crazy, isn't it?
Sorry, right, mate. So... do you think our listeners can switch on again?
Mate, that was...
I didn't realise you were like a major fan.
Fucking mega, mate. I was mega when I was younger, mate. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Went to SummerSlam 92 at Wembley. Right. And one thing...
just can't stop.
I can't, man. One thing that you're... there'll be a lot... by the way, you'll be surprised how many people...
No,
I was talking about it.
Yeah.
Ken and Carter.
Yeah.
I was there.
Yeah.
Loads of people there were talking about it.
Yeah.
And one thing that you're worried about, this coming week, all weeks,
whether the rest of this podcast is going to be about WWE or not. What am I worried about? I am worried about a lack of not enough momentum in our business. And there's a lot to do. And it's just, you know, it just take longer than you think. And even when you plan for them to take longer, they take longer. And I'm somebody that wants results quickly. And so I've just got to, like, you know, figure out the right thing. I'm also somebody that loves to generate loads of ideas because I think, okay, well, maybe that's the idea that's going to do it. But the problem with that is you've got to really, you know, manage your resources and time when you're a small team, small business. So that's it. It's just like getting the momentum. And we're at that point where we're putting a lot of energy into something, which is us trying to drive our digital side of our business. And it's just about kind of, you know, getting that momentum and really pushing and yielding on the investment that we're getting. So really, that's really the thing that's on my mind more than anything.
And is your the fact that you're going on holiday, because I forced you to go on holiday.
Yeah, thanks. My children are very grateful.
Yeah. They can thank me later, mate. They can thank me later. Does that affect that?
No, not really.
Will you switch off completely when you're on holiday?
Yeah.
Phone off, out of office on.
Yep,
definitely. No checking emails at all.
I might check emails.
You've got to check them, innit?
Yeah. I'm not... I could pretend on here that I'm not going to check my emails, but it's what gives me peace. It will keep my anxiety down if I just go, oh, yeah, that's fine. I'm not going to do any work. I'm not going to jump in. I'm not going to do any Zoom calls, none of that rubbish. But I'll keep an eye on it. Also, I'm addicted to email. There you go.
Yeah, no, you said that before, I think.
Yeah.
You said that like last week.
Yeah, you can't. I've got to feed my addiction.
Yeah, that's right. I can send you emails, mate, if you want.
Oh, not yours.
If yours
goes straight in the bin.
If you ever need a fix, I can forward you some of mine to answer if you want.
I do that anyway, don't I? There's no fix.
There's a lady on Instagram who I follow, Britt Frank, her name is, I think. But I saw her talking about, she said she's just written a book, right? And she was being asked about the book and how she got on writing it. And she said something on there that I bang buy into, yeah. And she was like, I don't buy into this work-life balance myth. She was like, it's a myth. She's like, you don't do anything that you love and passionately do it and do it in a completely balanced way. She was like, so when I was writing the book, when I was sprinting, I knew that I'd be up late sometimes writing it and I allowed myself to sprint. And she's like, and I would try to even things up as much as I could. But the idea that your life is ever going to be balanced, especially if you're doing something that you love, is unrealistic.
Yeah, I think it's easier to justify when it's that, when you're doing stuff you love or it's your passion or it's your business, right? In a way, it's when you're trying to seek out work-life balance when it isn't, you know, your thing that you're building, right?
Yeah.
So it's a noble... it's a noble cause to try and get better balance. But I do, an old boss of mine used to talk about work-life integration. And actually, so instead of saying, oh, I need to be downstairs and, you know, create boundaries here, you might say, for me, I'll do emails in front of the telly with a glass of wine and chatting. You know, for some people that works.
Yeah.
For others, they need the hard stop.
Fuck, give me a headache thinking about it.
Yeah, just too much stimulation.
But I talk about inclusion. As in, like, don't try and find balance in life. Just make sure you're being inclusive. So, like, if you've done too much of one thing for a long time, you don't have to try and balance it up. You don't have to pretend that if you've worked your ass off for 4 weeks, that you need to make sure that you're downtime for 4 weeks. Do you know what I mean? Just make sure that if you are working to the wire, that you're being inclusive and trying to create some space for that other stuff.
Inclusive, what does that mean in this context?
You're including all of the aspects of your life that you know need to be there. So from an emotional standpoint, from a kind of, if you're talking about work-life balance, yeah, family, social and work, you're never going to balance them all out perfectly and get them to this place where it's like, I do 75% this.
And, yeah.
Yeah. So just make sure that you're being inclusive in that, like, and that's what I try and do. I don't go, fuck, man, I've done a whole week smashing it out where I've hardly seen the kids. Next week, I have to make sure that I do loads of, like, making sure I'm with the family loads and loads and loads necessarily. But the next week I'll be like, I need to make sure I'm including my family time appropriately in this week. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think so. Balance, the metaphor that comes to my mind on balance is a seesaw, right? If I do this, then I need to do that, right? What you talked about and the metaphor I used to like giving is like a graphic equalizer, you know, like an equalizer on a stereo. Take the bass up, the treble down, the high, you know what I mean? And so actually adjusting the levels is exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And because you do that, you probably never feel like you need to do the seesaw.
No.
And that's why it's really important to adjust the levels rather than feel like you get to that point where you go, right, I've got to do, you know, a whole week of the opposite of what I've just done.
And that makes sense because last week was obviously Mental Health Awareness Week, right? So in terms of my check-in, I was flagging last week with all of the stuff that I deliver. Now, I know it's that week and so I always block it out and we, like, as a family, we know that it's like, I'm going hard. I'm a bit of a write-off that week. But I can see how burnout can come from people. You couldn't work like that every week like I worked. I was proper at breaking point by the end of the week emotionally.
Is that because of the kind of work you were having to do or was it because of the hours you were putting in?
No, the work that I have to do.
Yeah.
Like it was all emotive, yeah. Like the stuff that I was doing with Border Force earlier in the week was like really emotionally taxing. And then it was late nights and staying out and I hate staying out. I don't sleep when I stay out.
Especially when you're staying on someone's couch, is it?
Yeah, exactly. I've got to stay in Manchester this week and I've got to stay there because I've got to be there early on a Thursday for an event all day that's at a hotel. And I've booked at a hotel just around the corner rather than booking in the hotel that I'm delivering in.
Because
in case I see anyone.
You don't want to bump into anyone.
Yeah, man.
Any delegates.
Last thing I need, mate. Last thing I need. And last thing I would need in the morning when I go down for my breakfast, yeah, knowing that I've got to deliver a session in an hour or two and I want just a bit of headspace, is to fucking bump into someone.
And then you have to do breakfast together.
Oh, my days, man. You know, that's why I like being in London, because the chances of bumping into somebody that I know is quite slim.
I always bump into people I know.
What, in Tottenham, mate? Do you really?
Yeah.
Bump into people that you know.
It's really weird. It's like that serendipity thing where it's because it's so big and the likelihood of you, you know, crossing each other as you're walking down the street is so slim, but it always seems to happen to me.
Weirdest place you bumped into someone you know?
I don't know.
Oh, fucking hell. Come on, mate. It's not that hard a question.
Well, you answer it because you obviously have a story in mind.
Trefelli Fountain? Is it Trefelli Fountain in Rome? I bumped into someone I used to play football with.
Wow.
Yeah.
Great
beat
story.
That. Fucking beat that.
What are you worried about?
What am I worried about? So InnoU starts in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And so that means like going into June and stuff, I've got to work a lot of evenings. I don't like working evenings, man. And so like I find that quite emotionally taxing because I recharge when I'm at home with my family and I do my processes in the evening.
Yeah.
And because of breathing space as well, it means that there's a couple of evenings every week from June, like pretty much every week for 6 weeks, I'm working in a couple of evenings during the week.
Yeah. For how long? Just
six
June.
Weeks.
Oh, six weeks.
Yeah.
And what's on the other side of that? Nothing till September.
Yeah. So like I've got a project that I'm working on that I'll be working on that where I've actually had to clear the diary massively. So,
yeah.
Which I'm excited about.
What I do know about those spaces is as taxing as they are and as much as you're not enjoying the thought of it going into it, I know in the moments and what you get out of it is so powerful, like the space that you create. And even though you've done it several times now, most of that group will be experiencing it for the first time.
Yeah.
And that's really powerful.
Yeah, and it is. It's one of them things, yeah, that I am often like, oh, I've got, it's in it. Like, I'll be like, it's in a U tonight, and it's 8 till 9:30, yeah?
Yeah.
At night. So, because I try and do it so that people can join, put the kids to bed or whatever, and are able to join it in time. So there is a bit like, oh, I've got, it's in a U tonight. I can almost be a bit like, oh, I've got to do that tonight. And then every time, without fail, when I finish it, I'm like going up, waking Leah up. I'm like, it's in a U, so, like, it is the best thing that I do when I'm actually delivering it. Just in an ideal world, I'd love to do it at midday every day.
I think that's been the real transformation of you and your business and what you're doing in the world. Like, I think the corporate work was brilliant and obviously, you know, and continues to be, and that's really important. But, you know, moving into this space aligned with what you're doing kind of on your social platforms and stuff like that, I think it's really, really setting a defining moment for you and your work and like the impact that you're having.
I get a lot more freedom because I always say that the corporate work that I do is essentially healing work. I take healing work into the corporate space and I, you know, it's resilience work and all, you know, call it whatever. I like, when I'm being like completely candid, I say to people, if I'd have started now, I would probably be doing burnout stuff, but it would be the same thing,
yeah,
which is healing work that, yeah, I call burnout, because that's kind of how the game works, right? And I'm, you know, I'm not stupid or, you know, I'm honest enough to kind of admit that, but it's healing work at the end of the day. But yeah, you know, there's only a certain amount of it. When it's complete freedom and it's my own course, my own programs that I'm developing, then I can really get people to do, like, unapologetically, to do the work that I know that can be life-changing, yeah.
And you show up more authentically you, don't you, then?
Yeah.
Then.
Yeah, I think I do that in the corporate space, but I get more freedom to, like, be a bit more who I am, a bit sweary
and a bit sweary,
ranty,
yeah,
if I, yeah, feel like I want to be, yeah.
Talk about WWE for 15 minutes.
It's WWF, mate.
Oh, I was going to just say, do you call it WWF?
I weren't watching when they lost the court case that they should never have lost.
You don't like animals then?
Dead, pardon?
You don't like animals.
I love animals more than the humans. But yeah, mate, it's WWF. Right. That was good, mate. Okay, so we're going to do this deep question, actually. Have you come up with an answer for this?
What's the question?
Fucking hell, mate. It's someone's 18th birthday and they've been sent to you for advice to prep them for adulthood. What are you telling them? You haven't thought about it, have you?
No, I have. Honestly, I think the best advice I can give to somebody is to show up and authentically be yourself.
Mm.
And if I break that down, for me, I spent so much of my life considering myself to be a failure up until that point. Even through that point, I was probably at the peak of it, like, because I just kind of found out that I hadn't got A-levels that I needed to get into university, and that's all I'd been conditioned to do. So then I, you know, I'd always played this role up in this, you know, as I was going through school, I was the joker in the class because I wasn't able to apply myself academically. The reason I wasn't applying myself academically is because I wasn't conditioned to learn in that sort of, you know, in that sort of environment. And so in an elite school, I fell behind very quickly. So for me, I was playing different versions of people that I thought wanted me to show up in a particular way. And so what I've learned through life experience, blood, sweat, tears, pain, you know, lots of fails, some wins as well, is those moments where I've been happiest, where I've had most success, that's led me to be able to kind of build three businesses, build a team, work at the highest level in terms of, you know, corporate work, my corporate roles, is just being myself, just, yeah, showing up, being myself. And myself is the culmination of lots of different parts, as you and I have always talked about. Mm-hmm. It's not just one self, one authentic self, it's many selves. It's just listening to your intuition. And you will find yourself sometimes in a room where you're questioning yourself and the voices will be in your head, will be going really noisily in your head, telling you to show up in a different way, to act like the another person that you're seeing up on stage, or, you know, carrying themselves in a particular way, if they're an alpha character or something like that. And the instinct will be to just emulate them because you'll see other people just emulating them. And so you will think, in order for me to be successful, I need to emulate them. But actually, like, really listen to yourself, really listen to your strengths, your intuitions, and play those out. And sometimes they will take a while for you to really find your voice, who you want to be. So that would be the advice I give.
Yeah, you know, for me, if I was speaking to an 18-year-old to give them advice, like, the one thing that I would say is that you can always start again whenever you want, yeah? I would say to them, I wouldn't even get too bogged down worrying about a career at 18. I'd be like, go out, enjoy yourself. Try and get a job, earn a bit of money, go traveling, stay at home with your parents if you can, for as long as you can, so that you can go out and live your life, do everything that you need to do. Because I think, like, in some ways, we get people at 18, it's like, right, now you need to think about your career. And I think you don't. I don't think you do. I think you should enjoy yourself until you're at least mid-20s, at least. Because I think I didn't start what I'm doing until I was 30. And I worked in a factory up until I was, until then, right? So I started again then. I honestly think you should, life is for living and you should go out. Like, I tell my kids, for example, my daughter's nearly 17. I'm like, she's going to Reading Festival this year. She's booked to go on holiday next year. She wants to go traveling. I'm like, go do that shit, man. Like, I still don't really know what I want to do in my life. Do you know what I mean? At the age of 30. And sometimes I think we get too caught up in chasing success. And it's like, once you have kids, yeah, the whole fucking thing changes. What, you know that, yeah? Once you have kids, the whole game changes.
It's all downhill.
It's fucking all downhill. There's that bloke who's doing quite well online with his content at the moment. Have you seen him? I don't know who he is. He's famous for something else, but he keeps talking about he never wants kids and it looks horrible. What would you say is the perfect age to have children? Don't give me a naff answer where you go, well, if you're in love and you're ready, don't know.
I wasn't going to give you that. I was taking a minute to think about it.
Don't take a minute.
I reckon around 29, 30, 31, that's
Sort post
of age.
30.
Yeah.
Definitely post 30.
Yeah.
If you can help it, one of the greatest bits of advice I would give you is don't have kids until after 30.
When you were 16.
I had 5 by the time I was 30.
Wow.
I actually think I might have had 6. I had kids at 8, one child at 18, one at 19, one at 21, one at 22, one at 28, and one at 30, I think.
Man. And.
Shit. It's been a long
and. Life. You'll be young when, you know what I mean? That you'll be young and there'll be like adults with you. And that's quite fun. Like, I think being a young parent is hard, but then you reap the rewards, hopefully, on the other side of it once they're through.
The only thing that I would say, is like, and we're talking optimum here. So don't, like, I am not saying that young parents are bad parents, yeah? I was a young parent. Some of the most amazing parents in the world are young, right? And all that sort of stuff. But I'm talking like in a hypothetical land where we're looking for the optimum. Like, I really think if you can go and live your whole life, do everything that you want to do, yeah? Like, Leah, my wife, she did that. Went and did it. She did everything that she wanted. She was very ready to settle down then. There was no like, oh, I never got to do that or I never got to. She did it all and then was ready. And I think our kids, her children, will benefit from that.
Yeah.
I think, like, you know, a lot of people start really, really early, jump into it. And I didn't have the patience. I ain't got much patience now with my kids. I'd like to have more at 35. But, you know, I certainly didn't have the patience in my early 20s that I have now. And that's not true for everybody. But I certainly feel like in an ideal world, this fucking, like, you know, with the way that you can travel around the world and stuff now and really enjoy life, people should go and really, really do that. And then, you know, when you're really ready to settle down, then do that.
Yeah. Do you, I mean, just going back to what you were saying around at 18, just go and enjoy life, have fun. Don't worry about not having the answers. Do you think most 18-year-olds, I know some will be thinking, oh, I need to have all the answers. And there's, for some, there'll be a lot of pressure to know what they need to be doing at 18 because of the kind of academic route they might need to take at university if they're going that way or whatever. But do you think most 18-year-olds are actually just doing that, having fun, like, and thinking about going out and doing, like, not thinking about, like, what do I need to be doing with the rest of my life?
Yeah, probably. Most 18 are. And I think we should fucking let them. I guess that's kind of my point. Well, sometimes we don't, you know what I mean? Like, you know, when I was doing my GCSEs and that, and they gave you, did you get that little red book, the record of achievement.
We talked about this before. We did all that sort of shit
and made you feel like, you know, if you fail in these couple of years, your life's going to be a mess.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that was definitely, you know, that was definitely true of how I felt coming out, because, you know, we were told basically, this is it. This is your only pathway. And so all of my mates were going on that pathway. And I wasn't. So obviously, what do I walk away feeling? Like, okay, well, I'm not going to amount to anything. And everyone, all the teachers basically said that.
You'd never amount to anything?
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, let's go give them the V's to the camera.
But what I tell you what, another thing that I wish I'd known at 18 that I didn't know going in was how credit worked.
Yeah.
Mate.
Did you get in debt when you were
18? Massive.
Like, I remember I had a Virgin credit card.
Yeah.
And they wrote to me and was like, if your bank account is struggling, you can write yourself a check and put it in your bank account. And I can't remember. I had a couple of bags of sand on this credit card. I just fucking wrote the whole thing and stuck it in the bank straight away.
Jesus.
Man. Like, I was about 17 grand in debt at 24.
Yeah. I can't remember how much it was, but I was in debt. Because you just, you go, oh, all right. I'll go out on this, and then I'll go, oh, I need a bit of food. But then you go, okay, well, I can afford M&S food now, right?
Yeah.
And
then
boom, 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 boom.
Payday loans and that.
Yeah.
They banned them, I think, didn't
they? Yeah, I'd never got into that.
Fucking I did. I did a lot of them. It was lucky I chopped my toes off and got a payout and managed to clear all of my debt.
Wow. You almost did, though, right?
Well, I almost didn't, yeah. But we talked about that.
Yeah.
Right, Has, let's jump into today's topic. We've got quite a bit of time to explore it. I recognise that if you're listening to this, because we are recording a week before, to let the listeners know, this may, in a week's time, be sort of old news, but the conversation that comes out of it, I think, is evergreen. So I wanted to explore what has happened with Vinicius Jr., the Real Madrid football player. He was once again the target of racism at Real Madrid's match against Valencia on Sunday. He was met with racist taunts before getting off the team bus. And then the crowd were directing chants of mono, which I hope I'm pronouncing right. Well, I don't care if I am, actually. Spanish for monkey, at him in the 1-0 loss.
Yeah.
What's your initial feelings on that when I tell you that?
What do you mean, my initial feelings?
Well, when I say that this has happened to you, this has happened to Vinicius Jr., when you first seen that this had broke, he was sent off, I guess, is an important point to make. He was sent off because of his reaction to it. What was your first feelings when you saw the story?
He wasn't sent off for his reaction to it, but I think it was his reaction, I think, caused what he was feeling, obviously, what he was having to go through.
What did he do then? I thought he literally did the shush sign to the crowd.
No. I think he either, you know, he hit a player in the face, or he hit me with his arm or something like that. He, you know, went in hard on a tackle or something
that. Lost his shit, basically. Yeah.
But it was because of what happened. Obviously, it was, you know, it was totally understandable. I'm sad that, you know, that is still happening.
Yeah.
But also not surprised. Like, I don't read a story of a black player being racially abused in Spain, and I'm not shocked by it anymore, which is a sad thing.
You've highlighted Spain there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think it's worse there than perhaps other European countries then?
Because Spain has a lot more press, right? Than say, I don't know, somewhere like Slovakia or Serbia or Russia, right? Yeah. We read about it more. So I don't know that it's worse. I don't think it is. I know it happens to black players who play in the Russian league, for example. But because, say, you got Atletico, you've got Real, you've got Barcelona, you've got the big Spanish teams, mm-hmm. you just see it more. And there are more non-native Spanish players that go in, particularly sort of Brazilians and things like that play for the top clubs. And so, yeah, I've called out Spain because it happened in Spain, but, you know, you probably come onto this. Like, it, you know, when it happens time and time and time again and there's very little repercussion and there almost is acquiescence to it by the infrastructure, you start to think, well, you know, maybe there's some truth to the fact that there is an infrastructure of racism within that country.
And I think it's worth highlighting as well, right, that this wasn't like one or two fans in the stadium saying this term that they were chanting. It was basically the whole stadium, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was singing this or chanting this thing at him. Now, apparently, this was...
It's not isolated, by the way. So it probably happens every match.
Mm.
It just... It makes it into newspapers sometimes when it's so significant. So it's not like, say, 95% of the matches are racism-free and then suddenly this was just a one-off. It just happens all the time and it sort of blows up at moments, and this was one of those moments that it blew up.
Because apparently it's happened to him in particular over 10 times this season.
Yeah.
And did you know that Spain recently signed some sort of... I can't think of the word, not proposal, some sort of like contract thing with Brazil to say that they're going to really clamp down on racism as two nations. And Brazil have like come out strongly with this and asked for sanctions, asked Spain for sanctions.
Yeah.
They blacked out the thing in Rio, you know, the, what's he called? The Jesus thing.
Right.
They
really?
Blacked it out for a day in solidarity with him. And they're asking for sanctions. What do you think is an appropriate sanction in this place? And do you think an appropriate sanction will work?
Firstly, I'm going to just reverse it and ask you what you think an appropriate sanction is, because it's not really for us to think about what the appropriate sanction is. Because I could say something like penalty, 50-point penalty, massive fines for the clubs, something that sort of hits the clubs, but that doesn't change anything.
Mm.
But certainly something more than, say, one person. So I read somewhere that one person had his season ticket suspended for 3 years.
Yeah.
As a result of what happened.
One person at one point got a one-year ban on one of the incidents.
So I don't know what is right, but that is woefully fucking not enough.
Yeah.
And so it shouldn't be to us to figure out what individual penalties. This is a systemic problem. So there needs to be, there's penalties, but there's also, that isn't going to fix it. Like, you've got to figure out what
it
is that needs to change.
Yeah, that's why I made it a two-part question, as in, what do you think the sanction is?
Yeah.
And then...
What do you think?
I think it's difficult because I think, what do? You go empty stadiums for a few games and they lose loads of money. I don't think that'll stop the fans doing it or chanting it. I think a points deduction. They're in a relegation battle, that Valencia. Yeah. So like a points sanction, I think, would make people really look at... What I think it would make people do is look at whether they should be overtly racist within a ground. But I don't think it tackles the problem. And I've actually heard, like, in the past, John Barnes talk quite a lot about this, but he gets quite a lot of stick from a lot of different angles, because he says, there's no point in banning it in stadiums. Because, like, banning it and stopping it coming into stadiums doesn't make it go away. And he said, and in some ways, it sort of pushes it underground. Would you agree with that?
I disagree with that. Because
mm-hmm.
then what? Then you're sort of admitting defeat. So.
But he is. Caveat it by saying, he's not saying, well, no, just don't bother.
Yeah,
he's saying we need to do some actual work properly to try and look at why racism exists.
How about both?
Yeah.
How about you stop it being so overtly possible, right? I would say, I've been to a few grounds. I say, because of the work that's happened in the UK that has kind of pushed it out of the terraces, right? So it doesn't mean that it doesn't mean that people aren't racist. I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
But what they can't do is overtly do it. It starts to address the options of being more inclusive in grounds, right? So actually you can start to get a different mix of kind of people coming to the grounds. Now, I imagine a lot of traditional fans will say, well, that's what's changed the nature of like stadiums now. And actually it's not, it's all a bit prawn sandwich and a bit vanilla and a bit, you know, and I think some of the big stadiums are accused of it being quite, you know, watered down in terms of atmosphere. But actually, if that starts to bring more inclusion into stadiums because you've taken hard sanctions on zero tolerance on racism, then that's really important. If you can just wantonly get away with it in stadiums around Europe, then that just continues to feed the frenzy. Like it's something called the broken window syndrome. A guy called Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book called The Tipping Point. And he gave all these brilliant anecdotes about what was the tipping point for change. And he referenced kind of New York in the 70s and 80s was like a lawless place, right? I don't know if you know much about it, but it's absolutely, it was crime ridden, drug ridden. It was a bad place, it was dangerous. And there was a police commissioner who came up with this notion called the broken windows syndrome. And basically there used to be like neighborhoods where if there was a broken window, kids or like, you know, like the youth would like keep throwing like rocks at the windows because they're like, well, if it's broken and no one fix it, who cares? Mm. But actually when they started to replace the windows, that had an incredible impact. And it started to help turn around the city because people had more pride. They said, oh, well, people care about this place now. So actually, if you allow the broken windows to happen, then it's never going to change.
And what are some of the sanctions, putting you on the spot a bit here, but what are some of the sanctions in the UK that have worked then?
I don't know enough about it, but what I do know is, so I think...
I think instant lifetime ban would happen.
Instant lifetime ban. I think the clubs feel like they have a lot of, you know, they feel a bit more like they have solidarity behind it. There feels to be I think the FA seems like it's got more of a backbone than La Liga. Like I don't know if you kind of wrote down what the La Liga president wrote, but well, you know.
Yeah, should we go there?
Well, yeah. And so I think there's just there's a bigger infrastructure around inclusion and stamping out racism. It's still so much work to do. I think there's still going to be lots of incidents. You know, we saw it ourselves, didn't we, when the three lads missed the penalties and what happened as a result of that after World Cup? Was it Euros?
It's the Euro final.
Yeah, Euro final, yeah. There's still loads of work to do outside of the grounds, don't get me wrong. But I think within the grounds, I think there's been a lot of progress. It certainly feels like it anyway.
Because the Spain president or whoever it was has basically come out and sort of implied, well, he sort of brings it on himself a little bit with some of his dancing celebrations and stuff like that. Right, he has implied that, hasn't he?
Well, yeah, he's done a bit of whataboutism, right? Yeah. So, you know, what about this? And I called him to two meetings and he didn't show up to them. Why is it Vinicius Jr., a 22-year-old's, responsibility to turn up to meetings with the La Liga president and to kind of defend? And the fact that he sort of basically, you know, he feels like he has to defend La Liga and Spain, and he said there's only been like 9 incidents or something like that, which is absolute bullshit. So I think he is trying to appease who he thinks are the majority audience, not the few, right? So there may be a handful of players that are not Caucasian, right? Mm-hmm. Within La Liga. And then in terms of communities, there's probably a handful versus the majority. And his response is the saddest thing about this whole
episode. Do you think they will act as a result of this, though?
Well, there seems to be more pressure than normal, but I think it'll disappear.
Why do you think there is more pressure? Because here's one of the reasons I think there is and I was listening to Talk Sport this morning, actually, and they had their Brazilian expert on there. I forget his name, but he's fucking really good to listen to. He said it's almost unfortunate that Spain will have their hand moved here because we are reaching the point now where some of the best players in the world who are players of colour are going to come out and say, if you don't want racist abuse, don't go and play in Spain because it's part of the package.
I think he has basically called it out. Vinicius Jr. has called it out as vocally, as vociferously as can be done. He's basically said, football is racist, La Liga is racist, and I'm afraid Spain is racist. And we talk about it in Brazil, about how racist this country is. So Real Madrid want to get Jude Bellingham. They want to get Mbappe. You know, the biggest players in the world. And I think, you know, it sounded like Bellingham was going to be a shoe-in for Real Madrid. He may still come, you know, but it's really interesting timing. So I think that's the thing. The thing that will make them change is not a noble thing. It's commercial interests. That's what I think will make it change.
And just quickly, because I want to pose another question that's related to this. If this had have happened in an English stadium,
yeah,
what do you think? I know it's a fucking bit of a difficult rhetorical sort of question.
Yeah.
What do you think would happen here? Shall I tell you why I'm asking?
Yeah.
Vinicius has come out, like you said, and essentially said that as a result of this, we know that Spain is a bit of a racist country. I remember, I couldn't give you the date, but it was a couple of years ago, fairly recently, although I seem to say things are fairly recently and then I look and it's 10 years ago, but I think it's in the last 2 or 3 years. Stormzy said Britain is racist, didn't he? He said Britain is racist, and then somebody said, you think Britain is actually racist? And he said, yeah, 100%. And then people took that as him saying Britain is 100% racist, which was wrong.
Yeah.
He was saying, yeah, I 100% believe that Britain is racist.
Yeah.
So do we get a little bit like pointing away at other countries like Spain? Are we any better?
Well, I think you're conflating two things, right? Are our nations racist? Is there... You know, prolific racism in both countries.
Let's go there first. Do you think Britain is racist?
I think there is still a lot of racism in this country. Yeah. I do.
Yeah.
And I think you see it from very overt experiences like we witnessed there that happened in Spain, but then it's a lot of insidious stuff that we've talked a lot about on this podcast.
Yeah.
Do I think every Briton is racist? No, of course not.
Yeah.
Do I think large swathes of the country are not racist? Yeah, of course. Do I think that there's a lot of underground racism that we don't hear about? Yeah, loads and loads and loads.
Yeah.
And then there's just stuff that's bubbling on the surface. It's always inherent. It's in the media. It's everywhere. So it's not a surprise.
Yeah, because of that reaction that was on Twitter after the Euros.
Yeah.
Was probably not too dissimilar. If you collated everybody that made comments on Twitter together, you'd fill that stadium in Spain, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So when you look...
Two or three times over.
Exactly. So when you look at it like that, you have to start to say, well, hang on a minute, is it just as bad here, but it's a little bit more...
It is just
as bad.
You sort
of know that you can't, you know, because we have lifetime bans now. Yeah. I think that would happen, yeah?
Yeah.
If that happened in England, what I would like to think would happen, and I do believe would happen, is they would use all of the camera evidence that they could, and anybody caught on camera chanting in that way would get a lifetime ban. I do think that would happen in England.
Yeah.
But does that mean that we're any less?
No, that's
racist?
What I'm saying. I don't. I think there are two different things. You have to recognize that, you know, inherently we are still a racist country. What I feel like, and I don't know the stats, but I imagine we are more of a mixed and blended nation than they are in Spain. I think there's probably less migration percentage, mixed than we have in our country. So I think there's just there's more pressure to transform culture here than there may be in sort of countries within Europe, Spain being one.
Yeah.
Right? So it's still very, very nationalistic in many ways. And I mean that in a good way as well. I don't mean just in the negative sense. There's a lot of strong national pride. I'm not saying every Spanish person is racist either. Like, you know, it is. But what I think is there is an inherent hardwiring around nationality that just allows those really right-wing, extreme right-wing views to kind of come out. And there seems to be very little, repercussion.
Yeah.
For being public.
So on that, if we move towards I think we can talk about sanctions that you could bring into a stadium that were certainly, like you've explained, I think really, really well, why those sanctions within a stadium could have a positive impact, net impact long term. Yeah. In terms of stamping it out, bringing in... I always bring it back to when you said that you've never been to an England game because it don't really quite feel right to you. And I was a bit like, fuck, what? Like, almost couldn't believe it. And that really humanized the issue for me when you said that. But I guess if you're making sure that it's stamped out, and that makes you feel more confident that you're not going to hear shit that's going to make you feel uncomfortable, you're much more likely to find yourself in a football stadium, right? And then that kind of will help to drive the change that we would need to see, right? Am I making sense in what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Partly.
Yeah,
it's not going to solve the problem. Yeah. But it's certainly like a positive thing. If we look at more of a sort of like the approach that we would need to take to really start to tackle it, and that's, I'm thinking more about what we would do to tackle it in society nowadays. What do you think are some of the major barriers that we face that make it difficult to really tackle this properly?
I mean, I don't know if we've talked about this before, but I don't think you're born racist.
Mm.
You don't born hating, you learn hating.
Yeah.
And so much of that is obviously down to, you know, the environment in which you're raised. So it may be generational and it's passed down and you know, whatever. But so much of it is fed into by the lack of investment in people, right? So lack of investment in children, lack of investment in lower social mobility communities. So it just feeds the problem, right? So you think about the others, right? So you go, oh, I've got nothing. I can't pay my bills. Therefore, we blame them. And then the media feeds that. So I think education is kind of the only way that you're going to kind of get through it. But I'm hopeful also that, you know, we're sort of seeing the end of, we're seeing the end of the boomer generation, seeing, you know, we're emerging out of the Generation X. I'm hoping that, you know, whilst there are still lots of millennials and Gen Zers that, you know, harbour these views, I feel like there is hopefully a shift in this generation that's emerging around kind of culture, inclusivity, a bit more kind of connectedness. I'm not naive. I know that, you know, these things don't just disappear. In, you know, just because there's a changing of the guard doesn't mean that the, you know, centuries old practices shift. But I think there's hope that, you know, the emerging generations are going to, you know, drive different change.
I would say, at the risk of being naive here, if I was to look at the environments in which I first went to work in, what are we going back, maybe 15 to 20 years here, there's been huge strides. Now, again, that's not to say that it's gone, but there has been huge strides. Some of the things that I would have heard within the working environment that were seen as relatively normal, and, you know, for example, from racist jokes that were just text about normally when I first went into the working world, they would have been read out within work cultures normally, pretty normally, and you would have been seen as a little bit of a party pooper if you got offended by a joke like that. Like, I think in most work cultures that I can think of now, I mean, that would be seen as obscene. You know, I think of some of the younger sort of startups that I go into where it is a younger generation.
I think that's true. And I think if you think about, you know, cosmopolitan city areas, that's true, right? Startups are modern emerging businesses, probably out of like commercial centers, London, Manchester, Bristol, whatever. But if you're talking about, say, you know, a mechanics in, sorry, that's probably a little bit stereotypical, but, you know, mechanics in a village, there's probably still a lot of that still goes on.
Absolutely. But I mean, I do a lot of, I work with a lot of like construction companies as well, which is where you might think that there would potentially be more of it, right? Is that what you're saying, yeah? It's making a bit of an assumption.
Even big companies. It's the smaller companies that make up so much of our workforce that actually it could be anything from a 5 to 10 person company where actually it's just, they don't really kind of, you know, they don't kind of what's the word? Like, I won't say not obey, but they don't like run themselves by the laws of the land in the same way. So then they're going to be less probably bothered by, you know, what is kind of the, you know, the Equality Act now, but what used to be kind of race relations.
But, and I would say though, even if you went into like a working man's pub now, like from 15 years ago, again, not to say that it's gone, but I would say that there's been huge strides made, again, at the risk of being naive here. Am I being naive?
I don't think you're being naive. I just think you've got a very different experience to a lot of people that might be experiencing it. So you might think it and you might think, oh, this has changed. And it probably is true to some degree.
Yeah.
But I will walk into a pub and we talked about this, I have a very different experience to you.
Still get that? And we're really running out of time here, but do you still get that? Are there many pubs that you could walk into now and still not? I don't mean like if I walked into a real local pub, everyone turns it. You know, not that I don't fucking know anyone in here.
I
mean,
just a normal like London. Not really. Not in London. It's when you go outside of the major cities. That's when you start thinking.
Yeah.
And it's those ones, right? So if you think about that one that was in Grays in Essex, where you know they proudly put their gollywog dolls, and then the police raided them. Do you know about this story?
No.
So there's this pub in Grays. They had proudly put these gollywog dolls on. I think the pub landlord had ties to like the far right. Then the police raided them, took it down, told them to take it down. And then they defied it, put some back on. And then what was brilliant is that the breweries basically said, we're not going to work with you anymore, and they had to shut down.
You know what?
That's how it happens, by the way.
But that's good that happens. Yeah,
exactly.
And I know we've got a shutdown here, but I'm just like reflecting on my own, like, because I said, I purposely recognize sometimes when I might be being a bit naive and bring it on purpose to have it kind of corrected in that way. And when you have it corrected, when you say that, my first thought is, fucking hell, man, I can't believe that's still happening.
Yeah.
But then, we haven't got time to talk about it, but when you talk about, like, privilege, I guess when we, like, that's what privilege, how it shows up in my life, is when I don't fucking, that's not even on my radar. And if I'm not careful, as a white person, I can start, you know what you talked about with, like, the protest fatigue and that? If I'm not careful, I can get like, oh, come on, man, you're looking for it when it's not there. And my head will go there a little bit. And then it's having conversations like this that bring my head back round.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I
don't think it's naive at all, actually. It's because we create the space to have these conversations. And it's just a reminder that even though we think on the surface things are moving forward, they are. There's a lot of stuff that still hasn't happened below the surface of the water. The term the tip of the iceberg, it means that there's a load of ice below the surface of the water, and that's, you know.
And that's where the work needs to be done.
Yeah, exactly.
Mate, this has been brilliant. Really enjoyed it and look forward to the next one. Thanks again for listening to 115 Miles with Josh Connolly and Hassan Kai.